Welcome back to the Greg Hughes podcast, and today we're stepping back to the year 2002 to revisit a conversation with one of the most formidable figures in Donegal's public and commercial history, James White. A man who lived at the intersection of power and hospitality, James White's story is a masterclass in grit, rivalry and reinvention. Recorded at a time when the White Hotel Group was a juggernaut, boasting 1,500 employees and a staggering €500,000 marketing budget per year. This interview captures a titan of industry looking back on the scars and successes that defined him. Some of the episode highlights include the Ballyshannon beginnings. James recounts his early days in the grocery trade, where the foundation of his business acumen were laid. Politics out of spite. In a candid admission, he explains how his entry into Fine Gael wasn't fueled by ideology at the time, but by a burning desire to spite a local politician and business rival. The highest highs and the lowest lows, from the euphoria of topping the polls to the bitter sting of 1982. James discusses being passed over for a ministry by Garrett Fitzgerald, a decision rooted in the social stigmas of the time regarding his broken marriage. The Gildayan Kenny era, where we hear about the bad blood with independent TD Thomas Gilday, and White's perspective on a then fresh-faced Enda Kenny taking the reins of Fine Gael. Why it matters? Well, this just isn't a political retrospective. It's an insight into how personal setbacks in the Dáil fueled a massive expansion in the private sector. When the door to the cabinet closed, the doors to a hotel empire opened. It is a rare, unfiltered look at the man behind the brand, his frustrations, his triumphs, and his unapologetic approach to both the boardroom and the ballot box. Listen now to a piece of Donegal history. We pick up on the 2002 unsuccessful general election campaign.
You stand for election, there's no point in you standing unless you think you're going to win. And I thought I could take a seat. It's very easy to be wise afterwards. I had a wonderful campaign. I had wonderful workers. I really enjoyed every minute of it, and particularly about meeting so many people. You know, you've got to remember, I haven't been a TD for 20 years. I did stand 10 years ago. But since 1983, I just haven't been a TD. So 20 years is a long time to be out of politics.
Having said that, you did show very, very well and indeed come very, very close. And it was transfers in the end which perhaps gave Dinny the seat.
Well, I think Dinny certainly got a very strong Fine Gael vote. I would like to think is that I got a different kind of a vote, really. Even though I get a certain amount of the Fine Gael vote, I think the vast majority of my vote was a personal vote, and in certain areas I did exceptionally well. And you know, I got votes in most boxes throughout the entire constituency, but I was very, very happy with the vote. 20 years is a long time to be out of it, and a sitting TD, whether it's Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, they're always doing favours for people here, there and everywhere else. And it's not as easy as people think it is to take on a sitting TD. But as I said, I enjoyed it. I have no regrets about standing. I had a wonderful campaign. It's over now, and I suppose it must be a guiding hand somewhere above saying, get back into business. Maybe that's what I'm for, and maybe that's what I'll stick at.
And do you feel perhaps, though, if Pat the Cope hadn't been involved, it would have been a different story?
Very hard to say again. Pat the Cope's a very strong candidate, and certainly he was the strongest candidate that Fianna Fáil could have put up. Nobody can say that if some other candidate had stood instead of Pat, you know, what the realistic
result
would be.
Really, isn't it? Yeah.
But you've got to say is that Fianna Fáil got a very strong vote. They came first and second. And this is a Fianna Fáil constituency, and I know that better than anybody else because I've been fighting it, believe it or not, I've been fighting it for 37 years. 37 years ago, I stood first, and that's the year that Mary Coughlan was born. So, you know, I have no regrets. I've enjoyed, and I always enjoy a campaign. I enjoyed this one just as much as any other one.
And it's obviously an enjoyment you get from just meeting people, because that seems to be, for me, one of the main enjoyments you got from the whole campaign.
Well, I think when you're brought up in the grocery trade, as I am, and then you're in the hotel business, it's all hospitality and it's all about meeting people. And you can't run these type of businesses unless you genuinely like meeting people.
And have time for people.
Have time for people, talk to people and help people. And, you know, I think, you know, I love running the hotels. Mm-hmm. I love running the Abbey Hotel in particular, because I've often said it's like Euston Street Station. You meet all shades and classes of people in the Abbey, and it never stops. Mm. You know?
And it's a focal point, along with McGee's, it's the focal point of Ballyshannon, really. You know, where will it pick you up, McGee's Abbey? It's just that type of place as well, isn't it?
I think it's Euston Street Station. Yeah. You know, everybody seems to meet outside it or inside it or whatever. And it goes on, I hate to say day and night, but there is a lot of people around the Abbey in the Central Hotel, and it can hold a lot of people. Mm. And I think this is it, you know. And if you enjoy that type of business, you know, I'm not somebody that will sit in a back garden and do nothing or retire at an early age. I have no notion of that. I enjoy meeting people. I love running the Abbey Hotel.
And it's one of those industries that when you are an owner particularly, you don't retire. You just do it because you enjoy doing it.
I don't think you want to retire, because I think if you really enjoy meeting people, what do you want to retire for? There's so many people retiring, isn't there? And they don't live too long after. So.
No, it does seem to be that way indeed. Well, we'll talk more about that and a little bit more about the political aspect of it. But talking now about James White, the man, Ballyshannon man, and very proud to be that way.
Oh, yes. My great-grandmother was the postmistress in Ballyshannon. Her name was Sarah Mitchell. And where Abracadabra's is today, they had the post office there. But that's going back before the turn of this century. Mm. So, you know, the Mitchells in particular can claim that they're brought up and reared. And my grandfather was white, who came from Seskinora outside Omagh. Mm. And, of course, I'm delighted to be a Ballyshannon man. I'd want to live nowhere else in the world.
Mm. Tell us a little bit about your childhood. Well, not specifically your childhood, but were you raised actually in Ballyshannon?
Yes, I was born in Ballyshannon, and I went to school, first of all, in Bundoran, believe it or not, Bundoran National School, and from there I went to Pretoria and Enniskillen. Mm-hmm. And my father died when I was 13, and my mother died when I was 16.
Very difficult.
And it was a very difficult period, because we owned the Ballyshannon Bakery and we also owned a grocery shop. Mm. And of course I was the only son. I had five sisters, and I was brought up, and all my life I knew I was going to have to go into the grocery trade to help my father. My father died so young, and I still had to go into the grocery trade.
And did you feel that you had to almost adopt almost like a father figure role at a very young age?
I don't know about that. I had three elder stepsisters, mm-hmm. and I was boarded out to one of my stepsisters. But what I did feel at all times was that I had to go into the grocery trade, because that was the business that my father had. Mm. And I went away to Finlater's in Dublin in those days, and I served my time in Finlater's, and from there I went to Lipton's in London.
Mm. And your time, I think you went down around 17 to Dublin.
I was 19 when I went to Dublin. You remember the song, at the age of 17 I was apprenticed to a grocer. Mm. Well, I remember while working in Finlater's, and this bacon man used to sing this every blinking morning. He used to sing this at the, even though I was 19, but he used to sing it and tease me about it. Mm. And yes, I was apprenticed to a grocer, not far from Stephen's Green, as the song goes. Every time I hear this song, I still think about working in Finlater's in Dublin.
And in terms of moving down from Ballyshannon Bundoran, which relatively rural, to Dublin, was it any major difficulty for you in that regard?
No, at home they bought me a small Morris Minor car. One of the old Morris Minor cars.
Split windscreen.
That's it, yeah. That's the one. And I used to come home about every 2 months. But, you know, I had to serve my time as the apprentice to a grocer.
It's
a brave while ago now. I think I was getting a pound a week in those days, because, you know, apprentices didn't get very much. I think that was my pay.
And still, if you extrapolate it to now, it's still the same case. You often hear it with hairdressing and that type of thing, and electrician. But you have to do your time, I suppose, and that's just the way. Did you then move to across the water?
Yes, I went to Lipton's. With Mike and McGlone, and the two of us shared a flat together in Earls Court. And there I learned to be a supermarket manager. Mm-hmm. So for that year, I was trained as a supermarket manager. And actually we came back, and with Joe O'Rourke, who lives here in Donegal Town, mm-hmm. we opened the second supermarket in Ireland. Mm-hmm. Foodland in Sligo. That was the second supermarket.
Obviously then, it was a bold business move, really.
I can remember my sister coming down from Sligo about a month before we opened, and she pleaded with me to forget this stupid idea that the people would rob us left, right and centre, because of course it was unheard of in those days.
Of course, yeah.
If you can visualise the counters that used to be in the grocery shops, the counters were there, this, nobody could steal anything because it was just a long time after the war, but yeah. the sweets were still in bottles. And yeah, remember we had the cold storage butter now, I'm going back a long time now, and used to be always complaints in the winter time about this cold storage butter, and used to just have to serve the people over the counter. So it was a big, big step.
Did you get a lot of
supermarket?
Did you get a lot of people, say, for instance, who owned the grocery shop on the corner or the grocery shop here, saying, you know, concerned about their livelihood?
Not so much about that. No. It was a completely different style of shopping. Mm. And as I said, it was very, very early on in the supermarket business. And a lot of people took courage, I suppose, or maybe it was foolishness. I don't know. But I remember opening the one in Sligo when it cost us £1,700. And we lifted the £1,700 on the first day we were open. So that paid for the renovation. We couldn't believe it that we lifted so much money in the first day.
Mm. And you just hit on a fantastic business idea. Had you seen this model really operating successfully in when you were over in England, and
yes,
thought this can work here?
Correct. I was trained as a supermarket manager when I was in England, and I came back. And of course I came back with these newfangled ideas. But we were very lucky and it worked. And as you probably know, we had three supermarkets then. We had the one in Sligo, we had the one in Ballyshannon, and then we bought Callender's in Donegal and went under the name Foodland Supermarket.
Which is where Mary's is now.
Correct. Yeah. That's where Mary's is today.
And it was a conscious decision to go to a centre of population to Sligo. Did you research it from a market perspective and say this probably wouldn't work in a town like Donegal Town at this stage or Ballyshannon? We'd have to go to where the people are living effectively.
Well, I'm afraid there was no market perspective in those days.
Yeah.
It was taking a chance.
Yeah.
And it just happened by accident.
Very good.
Is that I met Joe O'Rourke, and Joe O'Rourke's family actually owned the shop where we opened. And we did a deal with Joe O'Rourke, and Joe O'Rourke and myself opened that supermarket. But I'm afraid there was no market perspective in those days.
Mm.
You didn't go into it the way we go into it nowadays.
And this was all part of a conscious plan that you thought would have to happen even at the age of 13? That eventually you would go into that trade?
Well, I think in those days, you see, is that when you're a young fella and your father and your mother dies and the shop was going to be yours someday, is that automatically you just didn't think. You said, you know, this is what is meant for me, and you hadn't got a choice, really, and I didn't have a choice. And I just went ahead, and I went, and I tried to get the best training that I could, and that's what happened.
Mm. Obviously, you spent some time in London, some time in Britain, and then back home. You must have adapted easy to all the different ways of life, if you know what I mean.
Well, I think for the first 6 months of my life in London, I couldn't understand why I hadn't gone to London years before.
Yeah.
You know, London was such a fine place. The women were there, the dances were there.
Land of opportunity.
Land of whatever you want to call it. We didn't really drink in those days, but we liked to dance 7 days a week. But I can also remember the last month that I was in England, I had a calendar on the wall, and I marked off every day until the last day came, and I will never forget it, and I never wanted to leave Ireland afterwards. It was the happiest day of my life, was the day that I left London.
I think a lot of people would be in the same position, even people that never came home, that spent their life in London or New York and never come home, to realise that you could have a good life here too.
No, well, I think there's different reasons and there's different answers to these questions. I think a lot of people can't come home because they get married and their family starts to grow up and the kids go to school and they just find they can't. And they always dream about coming home, don't
they?
That's
it, isn't it? Yeah.
And then, of course, their kids get married and then the grandchildren come and really...
You pull in one way and pull the other.
Correct.
And normally the family wins out.
That's right. But I was very lucky. I got out of it and I've never wanted to leave Ireland. I've never wanted really to leave Ballyshannon really after that.
And are you someone who enjoys travelling now that you'd probably have the resources to do so?
Well, I suppose, you know, as you know, I got into the hotel business and I've travelled the world and I've travelled half of the other world looking for business here, there and everywhere. When you get tired travelling after a while.
The hotel rooms and
the hotel, it's a lonely life. You know, when you go on promotion and you're away for 4 or 5 days or maybe a week, and you're away from home and you're away from your kids and you're away from your family, you're delighted to get back. And after a while, you know, I wouldn't say it's boring, but it's monotonous. You know, it can be a lonely life.
The gloss goes off it to an extent when you've done it.
So I have younger people now that love to go to these places like Copenhagen or maybe, you know, Scandinavia for workshops and places like that. And I'm delighted to see them going.
And you're offering them the experience that you had perhaps in London as well, you know, the chance to go out and see different things. How did you come from running supermarkets or in that industry to the hotel industry?
Well, I was in politics then in between.
So this was around 1965, you decided to get involved in politics.
What actually happened was, and I've often told this story but never on radio before, is that in 1965, Sean McNiff, you know, local Sean McNiff, the councillor, he opened a supermarket in competition to me in Ballyshannon. He bought me Gettigan and McGowan's old shop. I woke up one day and I said, here's Sean McNiff getting involved in supermarkets. It's about time that I had to come on. So I decided that because he was a Fianna Fáil County Councillor, is that I would look to see what opportunities there were in other political parties. So I went down and I saw Pa O'Donnell in Burtonport, who was the sitting Fine Gael TD. And I said to Pa, I want to join Fine Gael. Oh, he says, we're delighted. We're looking for somebody, he says, in the south of the county.
But you had no real Fine Gael connections prior to this?
Not that I knew at the time.
But they were in the same school of thought, though, when you actually
Time, but, you know, I can tell you, later on, when I fought the by-election 7 years later for Fine Gael, is that I was told then that my father always put a car out on behalf of Michael Og McFadden and Pa O'Donnell. But at that particular time, when I stood first of all, I said to Pa, how do I join? Oh, he says, very simple, go down, he says, and pay the local councillor Mick Milley £1 and you'll become a member. So 6 weeks after I joined Fine Gael, there was an election announced and I was thrown into the middle of this. In 1965, it's a long time ago now.
How did you do?
I got 4,500 votes, and I had never been in politics before.
There must have been a. Was this on your reputation as a local businessman, or was this from the door to door, or a mixture of both? Or?
Well, I think it was probably a mixture of both. At that stage, we had a wholesale business that travelled the length and breadth of Donegal. Mm. So therefore, because I was on the road myself. And I knew the shopkeepers in Annagry, and I knew Charlie Green in Fulcara, and I knew somebody else maybe in Dunfanaghy, and I knew somebody else in Dunloe, because I was selling them groceries from the wholesale business. I had those type of connections. And we had two big yellow lorries on the road, I remember, and we put up these big slogans, here comes white. Right? So it was something different because you had Cormac Breslin, you had Pa O'Donnell, and you had Joe Brennan, who were the three sitting people in those days. And I'd never been in politics. I didn't have any contacts.
And do you think it gave the constituency maybe a kick up the backside, for want of a better expression?
Oh, a big one in those days. A big, big one. I was only 27 in those days. And I got a lot of young people that you know, helped me then, and believe it or not, they even still helped me at the last election.
Mm. And 4,500 votes, very impressive. Moved on from there, obviously, you got the buzz. You got the kick off the politics for one of it.
Maybe I'm still getting the kick out of politics, but still, to answer your question, yes, I got the buzz. That was 1965.
And you knew it was an achievable mission, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see, you know, Paladin was an old... He was probably about 70, let me say, in those days. I wouldn't say he was that old, but he was probably 70. And the next election was announced was 1969. Mm-hmm. And some of Pa's right-hand men came to me and said, don't you stand in this election. If you don't stand in this election, we'll all back you at the next election because Pa's not standing again.
Which is it's a fair enough.
So it was fair enough. So I didn't stand in 69. And then Pa died in 1971. And then I got the nomination.
There must have still been a fair bit of pressure on you, though, from people who did support you to stand in that election, despite the request not to.
Well, there's always a lot of people that want you to stand for different reasons, you know. That was my right decision. There's no doubt about that. So when I stood in 1971 in the by-election, I stood against Paddy Delap, who was the local doctor in Gwydor. And we had a great campaign that time too, and Paddy de Lapp beat me by 1,500 votes. Mm-hmm. And then in 1973, when the general election came, of course, I got elected then.
And head down to the Dáil, obviously. I mean, all of this happening in a relatively short space of time, from little to no involvement in politics to being the leading light in Fine Gael, if you like, in this part of the country. Did you adapt quickly and well to the whole political setup? Any surprises for you when you went down there?
Well, I remember an old man, John L. Sullivan, who was a Fine Gael TD, who also fought in the War of Independence, and he says to me the first day, he says, "What's your name, young man?" I said what my name was, but he says, "Take one word of advice from me." He says, "Remember, it's not what you don't say will be remembered in this house, it's what you do say." So what he was trying to say to me was, you know, think carefully before you speak, because whatever you say will be remembered. Mm. And of course, you've seen it in the last election here in this constituency, where a certain gentleman didn't really think of what he said, and yet it was thrown up to him.
Who are we talking about here?
Well, Tom Gilley, of course.
James, when you did get elected to the Dáil, I mean, you were expected to deliver then.
Yes, I was.
And you did?
Well, the first I remember, I think Cormac Breslin then was made Cian Chóra of the Dáil. So that meant that it was just Joe Brennan and myself left to do the work. Joe Brennan, I remember well, was the Minister for Social Welfare. And, of course, he was busy, really, in Dublin a lot. And really, you know, I was young, I was active, and I started clinics. I was the first person in Donegal to start clinics. And I started clinics throughout the length and breadth of the constituency. But I suppose luck was with me, because, like, Cormac was Cian Chóra then, he couldn't be active, and Joe Brennan was tied up in his ministership. And really, I did a lot of the work in the entire constituency, and I was delighted to do it and delighted to help so many people. And I built up a good reputation for being a working TD.
Before we talk more about that, how did you manage to balance your business responsibilities with your political career?
Well, you really can't. Like, anybody who thinks, even in those days, and in those days, really, you know, the money wasn't anything like it is today, but even in those days, you just can't. You have to make up your mind. I was really a full-time politician. You know, I might have spent a half day every week looking at the financial side of it. And as far as the grocery was concerned, Joe O'Rourke took charge then of Foodland in Donegal. We sold the one in Sligo. And the manager that I had then in Ballyshannon, I sold that to him.
So you really had to give up the vast majority of your business interest to pursue the political side of it?
That's the way politics is. Mm. You know, if you want to be successful in politics, you have to be a full-time politician.
And do you think maybe that even nowadays some people can be naive, for want of a more sensitive way of putting it? But
I think if they are, they're very foolish. If anybody wants to be elected to the Dáil, you have to realise that it is, and even more so now than ever, because the salary is good. People expect a lot from you now to deliver, as you said yourself. And I think it's only right is that if you are a public representative, I used to be called, which I took as a compliment, was the bread and butter politician. Mm. And what it really meant was that I was looking after the people's needs if they needed anything. And whoever said that said it in a different kind of a way. They didn't think it was a compliment to me. It was the greatest compliment he could have given me.
And not surprising, really, the benefit of having the clinics, because people want to see who's representing them and they want to have access to them, even now.
Well, I think, as you know, this is a very big constituency. It starts in Bundrawas, down at Bundoran, and it goes right up as far as Fillcarra, right around to Creaslough. And every month I used to visit that constituency. So if somebody in Annagry or Fillcarra or anywhere had a problem, at least I was in the area every month. And cars, remember, weren't as plentiful then as they are now. You know, it's amazing how things have changed. Like, two of the main things that I used to have to sort out for people, one was telephones and the other was ESB connections. And when you think in those days with the telephones, you used to have to get a pole to bring a telephone line into a house. And to think nowadays that you have a little mobile, you know, about 6 or 8 inches long that you can stick into your pocket and you don't need any poles or anything. But those were my two main problems when I was elected.
And also, actually, quite difficult things to work on, I'm sure, because the powers that be have always, people would argue, neglected the extreme northwest.
Well, you know what, I got to do a lot of talking for the North West. I was lucky because when I came into power in 1973, Fine Gael also came in the coalition government. And I had some very, very good ministers. Like Paddy Dunnigan was Minister of Defence, I had Dick Burke as Minister of Education, different people like that. And even though I was new, I had a way with me that I could get into these offices and get things done for the people. And I made sure that my voice was heard.
And what are your most memorable times of that spell you had down in the Dáil?
Well, I suppose, you know, looking back on it, there's a high and a low. I suppose there's a high and a low in it, any business that you're in. I suppose the high was in 1977 when I topped the poll in County Donegal by beating Neil Blaney for
which
the
was
first
a
time in his life.
Superb achievement, really, wasn't it?
It was. The county was all won, so it was probably easier for me to top the poll that way than if it was divided. And certainly the downside was when Garrett Fitzgerald came into power in 1981. Is that I didn't even get a Minister of State, and really I never got over that.
Were you a bit
gutted?
Bitter, maybe?
Absolutely gutted and bitter. And I made up my mind then, is that, you know, I wasn't going to stand as the next.
Why do you think you were overlooked, personally? I mean, maybe you never found out the reason, you never will, but why do you think you were?
Well, it's one of these things that nobody really ever tells you why. But if you ask me what I think because I had a broken marriage at the time. And I think, you know, it wasn't popular in those days to even think of remarrying again. Certainly a broken marriage was something that everybody kept hidden. As far as I was concerned, I never really kept it hidden. And, you know, if you're asking me an honest question, I think that has to be my answer.
And if you were, if that had been explained, if that had been explained to you at the time, would it have gone some way maybe to, I know it's hypothetical, but was it the fact that nothing was said that...
Well, I think what really made it more bitter, and I just read where Willie O'Dea said the same thing last week, is that the Taoiseach didn't even call him in and say to him, this is the reason. In my case, nobody called me in and said, this is the reason that you didn't get it. Ted Neilan actually was given the Minister of Stateship that I thought that I was entitled to. But, you know, maybe looking back at it now, it was all for luck.
Indeed. And what doesn't... kill you makes you stronger, they say. So at this stage then, really your interest and perhaps even maybe your loyalty to the people who were running the party at that stage rather than the party itself had slipped away?
Well, I, with Paddy Hart, both of us were Donegal TDs and both of us were on the Fine Gael front bench. Like we were the top 15 in the country in Fine Gael. And not alone that, but I also looked after Sligo Leitrim, a bit of Sligo Leitrim, for the simple reason that one of their TDs there was old and wasn't able to do it. And I used to go to Manor Hamlin and I used to...
And you're in kind of a central position to...
Very central, you know, and I was delighted to do it and I had the energy to do it. I had no problem, but I really felt gutted. And as I said, you know, I can understand how Pat the Cope feels and how Willie O'Dea feels today, because it is a terrible slap in the teeth.
Do you think Pat the Cope feels like that?
Well, I'm sure if all I can do is think.
And give an opinion, of course.
Give an opinion, but also put myself in his shoes as I felt years ago, 20 years ago.
But as you say, maybe it was a good hand that you were dealt in the end, in the long run. You just decided not to run. Was the how did that, your decision not to run, how did that go down within the party and within your supporters, obviously, which you'd have had a great sense of loyalty to? Was there a pull between your bitterness and the loyalty of the people who helped you get there?
Well, I don't think anybody really believed I wasn't going to run. I said it on numerous occasions before that, is that, you know, I came to a crossroads in my life. I didn't think I was getting on with Gareth Fitzgerald. I didn't think, you know, I got what I thought was for me. And, you know, I had said it on numerous occasions. When it came to the crunch and I made the announcement, really there was no going back once you made an announcement to the media, as you know. You know, say, so hang on to this. Like, that's
it. Shinee.
But, you know, I went down to, we owned the Hydro Hotel in County Clare. And Morgan Delaney was running the Hydro Hotel in those days, and he gave in his notice about 2 months after I stepped down. And I had never put my foot really into an hotel. I had never pulled a pint of Guinness in my life, and I didn't know how to do it. So it's amazing when you have to do these things how quick you learn.
You got into the hotel industry. Obviously, the
the ability to meet people, and obviously your political reputation also would have helped significantly in the in that industry.
No, a completely different business. Yeah. You know, we actually owned an hotel in East Inverna in those days, and it was under the management of a manager.
Yeah.
And here I was, really with nothing to do. The chaps were really gone.
Mm-hmm.
I was out of politics. And the manager in the hotel gave in his notice. And here was another challenge. And I suppose this is what life is about, isn't it? It's about accepting challenges. And when you accept a challenge, you try to make sure they succeed. Now, every day isn't a good day. There's a lot of thunderstorms in business, as well as good calm days as well, as you know yourself. But this is what happens. That's why I got into the hotel industry.
And how did the business grow from there? Obviously, it must have been a very successful hotel.
Well, it wasn't in those days. In those days, it was a 49-bedroom hotel. And why I really got involved with it was that in those days, again, I knew that in the grocery trade, by working 52 weeks of the year, if you made £5,000 for the year, after working 52 weeks, you were doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And here was the hotel where we'd open on the 1st of June in those days, and we shut on the 1st of October. And with all expenses paid, we'd probably make £10,000.
Mm.
So I could see that if I filled the bedrooms and stayed open longer, there was far better money in the hotel trade in those days than there was in the grocery trade. So it was as simple as that.
Mm.
It was a pragmatic decision. And I had to get out and I had to sell it. But of course, you know, like every other business, you make some wrong decisions as well. And there was 2 or 3 years that really it didn't improve that much. And then suddenly we started to get the tours back in.
Mm-hmm.
And once we started getting the tours in and had our occupancy, then we started to make good money.
And did you organise the marketing for yourself at that stage? Did you see that you had to provide a package, you had to actually go out and entice people to come to your hotels?
Oh yes, we had to do a lot of selling. Like, we still do a lot of selling. We've 2 girls full-time in England, we've 2 girls full-time in Germany, and their job is to go out and to sell package holidays and to bring them into the different hotels that we run throughout the country here at the present time.
And when you say, for instance, acquiring a hotel, location obviously is everything, is it?
Well, we bought the Hyde Hotel in East Inverna, not so much for location, but because we thought there was great business in this town, because it had the name of the matchmaking season in East Inverna, and of course the September Festival. And I used to pay a visit there every year for a week's holidays. And of course, looking at it now, I thought there was a far bigger business in East Inverna than there was, right? But it took a lot of time and a lot of effort and a long number of years to build it up and to get the name to List and Varna. And of course, we were lucky as far as that was concerned as well, because I happened to meet Willie Daly, who was the matchmaker there. And his father and his grandfather were the matchmakers before that. And we just hit on
making
something.
Making connections as well.
That was unique. You know, it was completely unique.
Yep.
And we just hit it at the right time. We were very, very lucky, and it's been very, very successful.
Along the way, you've progressed to a group now with hotels everywhere. Hugely successful for you.
Well, it's successful now, but still there's a lot of work and there's a lot of borrowings involved.
Mm.
But, you know, there is a big business. We employ 1,500 staff at the present time throughout the length and breadth. Probably in this town of Donegal, we probably employ about 350.
Mm.
Oh, we mustn't forget Loretta. Loretta told me to mention, I was in the Abbey on Sunday, and Loretta says, I always listen to this programme on a Monday night. And I said, where are you from, Loretta? Oh, she says, I'll be listening from my bed in Enniskillen. So Loretta, if you're listening, we didn't forget you in Northwest Radio.
And indeed, Loretta, we'll play the next song for you, so hopefully something you enjoy. You have a very high occupant. I remember you were on Father Ono Friel's show, and you have an all-round year targets, I'm sure yourself, in terms of rooms being occupied. It's very high, something in the 70% year-round in Donegal, is it?
Well, I would think probably in Donegal it's about 65%.
Which is all year-round, that is.
Yes, all year-round. Well, you know, we're very lucky here in Donegal. Mm. Is that we have this Northern Ireland business. And nearly every Friday and Saturday night, I think probably every hotel in Donegal County fails.
Mm.
Because, you know, we're such good value for money compared with Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And then do you say, for instance, would look into the future, say, if the sterling weakened or the euro became strong? These are all things that could, that you have to, I'm sure, always have in mind when you're running hotels, is it?
Well, there's no doubt about it that if we were pound for pound at the present time, or pound for euro, whatever way you want to call it, mm-hmm. and if Northern Ireland wasn't such good value here, is that we would find it far more difficult, because not just do you get the weekend business, but you get weddings. You know, like nearly every Friday and Saturday we have a wedding or two, as Harvey's has and as the Great Northern have and places like that. And a lot of these weddings, funny enough, are coming from Northern Ireland.
Because it makes complete financial sense, doesn't it?
Sure, sure. Like there's 20% of a difference. Mm. And you have to say, why does anybody in Northern Ireland have the reception in Northern Ireland when there's such good value for money in the state of the border?
For example, someone from Northern Ireland, say from Bleak, can go down to Murphy Golf Course, play one of the best golf courses in Ireland for 20 sterling pounds, I suppose. You know, I mean, these are the attractions that we have here. But yeah. It has to be marketed too. These people don't just wander over the border by themselves, though. I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, you have to actively seek that business.
But we would spend probably between all our promotional work, probably the guts of £500,000 marketing all our hotels with our marketing staff and what have you, you know, advertising in the different papers,
yeah.
trying to fit up the gaps. We're looking now, for example, for October, November, mm-hmm. December and Christmas and the new year of this year coming. That's as far as we're looking ahead at this stage. But you cannot forget, you know, the wonderful county that we live in Donegal as well, mm-hmm. and the wonderful advantages that we have. We have to watch our pricing structure. There's no doubt about it, because, you know, when you're waking up in the morning like this morning and it's pouring rain out of the heavens, and if you had a week off, you know, are you going to go to, let us say, the Earl of Desmond in Tralee?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you going to get on a plane and go to somewhere in Portugal,
yeah.
where you're sure that the sun is going to shine? You know? No, yeah, we can do very little about the weather, but we can certainly try to give better value as far as good food is concerned, as far as accommodation is concerned.
Entertainment.
The crack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Irish people love the crack.
It seems to be something that I know, even going down to Dublin, that the emphasis doesn't... we seem to be losing the hospitality edge in places like Dublin, that personal, you know, that you're really being looked after, that's something that we'd never want to see in this part of the country.
Well,
do you agree with me that do you see that, no?
I'm amazed to hear you saying that, because I was down in Donegal on Sunday.
In Dublin?
Well, in Donegal on Sunday. And
three
people said to me, we'd love to come here because of the friendliness of the staff. And it's something that we cannot, you know, lose mm-hmm. here in Donegal. And I think this has always got to be one of our best selling points. But you are right in Dublin. Dublin has become a cold, impersonal city at the present time because it's getting too big.
And an expectation and a presumption that the business is going to be there as well.
But there's no such thing as, you know, we've got to work on these.
Well, I'm sure they'll feel the effect of it 5 or 6 years down the road.
Yeah, well,
there's no doubt.
The occupancy in Dublin is still, I think I'm right in saying the occupancy last year in Dublin was a colossal 93%.
Which is unbelievable.
It is. That means they're full nearly every night of the week. 93% is a very, very high occupancy.
Mm. In any place, I would say. Just talking about the election. And switching the subject. Now, we're just talking about the election because I don't want to keep you too long more. I don't think anyone begrudged Dinny McGinley getting the seat in the end, did they? In terms of there's no doubt your involvement helped the Fine Gael party in this constituency.
Well, I'd like to think that the reason that I ran was to make sure that the vote, particularly in the south of the county, held up.
And compared to nationwide, it did.
Well, we increased our vote. We were the only constituency in the entire country that increased our vote, and we increased our vote considerably. But saying that, Fianna Fáil still lifted first and second seat in Donegal, and Dinny McGinley lifted the third. You know, I shook each of them by the hand, and, you know, I wished them the best of luck. As far as Mary Cockton is concerned, I'm delighted to see that she's been appointed a minister. So, you know, we're delighted to see such good representation that we have in this constituency. That isn't the reason that I stood. The reason that I stood was that I wanted to offer the people an alternative mm-hmm. to what they have at present. And I thought I was an alternative, and the people decide. And once the people decide, you dust yourself down. It's like getting into the boxing ring when you're a young fella. You know, you either win or you lose. If you lose, you dust yourself down.
Come back again.
And you get ready again. But you
know, it was a very strong...
Saying all that, mm-hmm. I think it's time that younger people did take an active role in politics mm. in this entire constituency, mm. and I'd like to see that happening.
And were you pleased then to see the likes of Joe Kelly and Thomas Pringle and people like that? They all did reasonably well too.
Well, I thought they did very well. And you know, when I go back on my own life, and I think that I stood at 27, and here's these young fellas standing, and Joe Kelly in particular, I thought he fought an excellent campaign.
And perhaps wasn't reflected his campaign, as a lot of people were saying they were impressed with him, but at the end of the day, when people went to the ballot box, he didn't get that many votes, really.
Well, you see, the sad thing maybe about politics in all of these constituencies is that people remember the little favours done by the mm. working TDs. And I've often used the phrase, and I'll use it again, is that two medical cards in two different houses means that those two houses are probably going to work for the person who writes a letter and sees that those people get their medical cards. But if those people had written a letter themselves, they'd also have got the same answer as what the politicians have got for them. Mm-hmm. And with the best policies in the world, you know, and I have to say is that as far as my campaign was concerned, we looked at the policies that are affecting the people. What I know now, a couple of weeks after the election, is that people voted for the TDs because they did them little favours here, there or somewhere else. I was talking to a lady in a jeweller shop in Ballyshannon today, and she was fixing my watch, and she says, you know, my sister in Kilcare didn't vote for you. Oh, I said, is that right? And I come from a good Fine Gael family. Yes, I said. Why is that? Well, because Mary Coughlin got the road tower to her house.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm trying to say, yeah. is that people in rural Ireland remember the little favours that's done and not the general policies, really. Mm. And fine, this is what working TDs are for. They're representatives, and it's only right that the representatives should work for the local people, which I agree with. The bread and butter politics mm-hmm. again.
Hypothetically, say Mary Coughlin or Pat the Cope or Dinny McGinley says, I'm going to Spain for the rest of my life and forget this politics malarkey. Would you stand again?
I know. As far as I'm concerned, I have stood, as I said, in different elections for the last 37 years. You have to be realistic. It's time that the young people yeah. really got active. I would love to see, it doesn't matter what party really, because once they're elected, they have to go after the people. But I would like to see the young people standing again. I would like to see the Fine Gael organisation being completely reorganised.
That was my next question. I mean, and the party was decimated really over in the last general election. Did it even surprise you how many big names, for one of, you know, if you know what I mean, lost their positions and weren't elected?
Well, first of all, let me say this. Personally speaking, I had a wonderful campaign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went around the entire constituency. I was received so well, I couldn't believe it. I was wondering what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it reminded me of an old story that I heard many years ago about an urban councillor in Bundoran standing. This is maybe 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And somebody said to him, Patrick, how did you do the night before the election? And he says, well, you know, if everybody has voted for me that has promised they're going to vote for me, I'm going to top the poll. So the votes were counted. He went home, he sat for his meal with his wife that evening, and his wife said to him, Patrick, how did you do? Oh, he says, I got one vote. He says, you're my wife and you didn't even vote for me. So, you know, people nowadays, even 50 years ago, are so nice to you, they're not going to insult you. But poor Patrick only got his own vote.
Mm.
So, you know, as far as I was concerned, the people were so nice. I had a wonderful campaign. I loved meeting the people. But I think the other story I told you was about the road being tarred for yeah. somebody. That house, even though they came from Fine Gael stock, remember the favour that was done.
Yeah, you've had like you've a 50-metre head start once you're there. But nationally, the party, though, I mean, it must have disappointed you.
Well, you know, the Fine Gael party, let's be honest, has to be gutted.
Mm.
There's a new leader now in Enda Kenny, and Enda Kenny has to be given, certainly a lot of credit for letting his name go forward. and hopefully...
Poison chalice, really?
Well, hopefully not. You know,
no, but I mean, he'll do with it what he can, but a lot of people wouldn't have put the names forward because it could have been seen as a poison chalice.
It can be, and it still can be, but like, he is a new, fresh face. He's a good-looking guy. He's really able to talk. He's a very nice guy to talk to, and hopefully he'll make a very good leader. Mm-hmm. And all we can wish him the very best of luck and hope that, you know, is that Fine Gael is going to get back to this. But they have also got to look, and they've got to look at the new political people that's coming up. A lot of these guys are completely dedicated. They've nothing else in their mind except work politically. You know, so, you know, you come back to this, it is a full-time job, and anybody who wants to get involved has got to realise, if you're going to be a county councillor, at least now you get paid for it. It is a full-time job. You've got to dedicate yourself to your people, and you've got to like meeting people, and you've got to be, you know, a nice kind of a person.
Genuine, really, effectively, is that you have to be as well. Because people on the doorstep can see through fancy posters and...
Well, I think most of the people that stand are genuine.
Oh, yeah.
There's no doubt about it. But, like, there was 10 candidates in the last election, and 10 into 3 seats doesn't go.
No.
So there has to be 7 defeated candidates and only 3 happy ones.
Yeah, that's it.
And, you know, anybody who says, you know, were you disappointed? Of course you're disappointed. I don't care who you were. Like, I think even the person who got the least number of votes in the last election has got to be totally disappointed. But also, if you're beaten by 10 votes, how would you like to be beaten? If some people were there by 5 and 6 votes at the end of a 3-day count, it must be really terrible.
Yeah.
Like Nora Owens, after serving the country so well, you know, a grandniece of Michael Collins's, to lose her seat and to be one of the leading lights in Fine Gael. You know, how long would it take that poor woman to get over that shock?
And just seeing as you mentioned Nora Owen there, we talked about Thomas Gilday earlier on, and he did make comments in relation to Nora Owen, and at the time you were very vocal. And I've had this conversation with people, was that really the motivation to get back into national politics? Was that enough? Because I believe he did say that at one stage, that...
Well, to be quite honest about it, why I stood the last time was for 2 reasons. First of all, the main reason that I stood was that I felt that if somebody in the south of the county didn't stand, I didn't let my name go forward for a long, long time, for the simple reason I was hoping that some younger person would take it up. But I also realised that there is that vote south of Donegal, that if somebody didn't stand in that particular area, that vote could go anywhere, and I mean anywhere. It mightn't have gone Fianna Fáil, it could have gone anywhere. That was really the main reason that I used to. But then when Tom Gilday also criticised Nora Owens, who was always a personal friend of mine when I was there, you know, that really...
Icing on the cake.
Well, I was going to say, you know, petrol to the fire, you know. But I have no regrets about standing. You know, I had a great campaign. I think we put on a great show. You know, at 64 years of age, you know, I think it's a very respectable vote, and I'm very proud. And I have to thank, really, the workers that went out day in and day out and worked on my behalf. Mm. And I suppose they probably feel more disappointed than I do. You know, as somebody said to me the other day, at least you have the businesses to go back to. Of course I have. And, you know, I just enjoyed it. I really did.
Mm. I get that impression from you that you wouldn't change it for a world, even though... You didn't achieve what you set out to do, and I'm sure you didn't get involved unless you thought you could do that. But at the same time, you've taken an awful lot of a positive aspect from it.
Well, you know, and probably 8 weeks of my life was spent at it.
Mm.
And, like, I toured the whole constituency. I was meeting people that I haven't seen for 20 years, really. And 20 years is a long time out of one's life.
Yeah.
But I think the important thing of all was, did you enjoy it, did you not? I did enjoy it. Would I change it? Of course I wouldn't change it. It's done. But I have to go on, and we have to encourage younger people to stand. And I think that
seems to be the consensus from people you talked to from within the party, that it needs need to be gutted and built from the bottom up with a fresh new look. We're letting you go now, Jim. Finally, before you go, your future, obviously, you're just going to keep on with the business and keep growing and expanding and bringing people here to Donegal and the rest of your hotels?
Well, you know, I'm a happy, good-lucky guy anyway, and happy doing what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally enough, we have to just continue to do it and do it that bit better. And, you know, whatever has to be, but as somebody said, and I think it's probably true, there's often a guiding hand there. Mm. And maybe the guiding hand is saying to me, right, stick to what you know, the business, look after it, see that you're employing a lot of people, see that you continue to give good employment and build up the tourist trade all over Ireland.
Well, there's so much we could have talked about, but obviously we haven't got all night. James, firstly, thank you very much. I know you're very busy for giving the time out to come in to us this evening. It's been very enjoyable, and as I say, thanks very much for coming in.
Always a pleasure, Rick.
Yes, indeed. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. A fascinating insight from a great man, Jim White, so influential in the world of politics and, of course, hospitality. Hard to believe that was recorded 24 years ago. Okay, that was a special Into the Archive edition of the Greg Hughes podcast. Don't forget, we have regular podcasts released every Friday on the Highland Radio website. It's also available, of course, for you to listen back to on Spotify and on the podcasting platforms from Apple and others. If you have any feedback in relation to this podcast, don't forget you can email us. You can email the researcher and the producer, Caroline Orr at highlandradio.com. That's, as I mentioned, for any of your comments, your feedback, your questions. So until we chat again, thanks for listening.